Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Survival, Revenge of the Living Dead, by Sean Harbinger. Narrated by John Keating. Chapter 1. It was late morning, with the sun beating through the Big Easy's portholes, when I rolled out of bed, feeling like I'd just gone 10 rounds with Mike Tyson. The cabin was bright and hot and smelled distinctly of sweat. I needed to get out of here and get some fresh air before the contents of my stomach, burgers and pasta, mixed with a liberal amount of red wine and beer, came spewing out over the bed. Groaning as a bolt of pain speared my head, I opened the door and stumbled up the stairs to the living area. It was no less bright or warm in here, and the smell of greasy burgers and alcohol hung in the air. I pulled open the door to the aft deck and threw myself outside, just in time to throw up over the side of the boat. A couple of minutes later, as I spat the last remnants of acidic bile and bits of burger into the sea, I heard a chuckle floating over the waves. I looked up to see the Lucky Escape anchored off our port side, and Sam standing on her foredeck. He wore red swimming trunks and a white shirt, printed with large red palm trees. He also wore a shit-eating grin on his face.
"Dude, I told you to slow down last night," he called. "You were chugging that wine like there was no tomorrow."
"Well, unfortunately, there is a tomorrow," I said, "and it has arrived." He chuckled again.
"Alex, you need to take it easy, man. We're going ashore later, and you need to be on top form."
"Top form isn't achievable today," I told him.
"Well then, you'll be zombie chow."
"Thanks for that, Sam."
"Just telling it like it is, man."
He turned away from the railing and went below deck. I sank down onto the bench that curved around the bow of the boat and wheeled my head to stop hurting. It didn't work. Why had I drunk so much last night? Deep down, I knew the answer. Since seeing my father and brother at Camp Achilles a month ago, I'd been in a funk that had been difficult to shake. I wasn't moping around like a moody teenager or anything like that, but every now and then I'd feel so down that I wouldn't know what to do. Everything seemed hopeless. Last night, the four of us, Lucy, Tanya, Sam and myself, had eaten together on the Big Easy, and we'd all partaken of a case of wine we'd looted from a shop last week. After the wine had gone to my head, I'd foolishly decided that a few beers would be a good idea, and had drunk at least 4 bottles of ale we'd taken from the same shop as the wine. I'd been trying to forget, to banish the black dog of depression that had been hanging over for me ever since I'd seen Joe and my dad. My plan had worked for a couple of hours, and I'd spent the evening in a fuzzy cloud of merriment. But it had only been temporary, and now I was paying for it. Getting gingerly up from the bench, I took a deep breath of salty air and walked through the living area before pushing through the door that led outside to the sun deck. As I'd expected, Lucy was there, lying beneath the beating sun in her yellow bikini, with a pair of shades over her eyes. She was lying on a dark blue beach towel that she'd spread over the deck, and her long blonde hair shone in the sun like a golden halo. She was a work of art, and I couldn't help but appreciate her, even in my less than optimal state. "Hey, Alex," she said, surprising me. I'd thought she might be asleep, but her eyes were obviously open behind the sunglasses. "How's your head?"
"It's been better," I told her. "I shouldn't have had so much wine. Everything is bright and I feel hot."
"Take your T-shirt off, then. It's way too warm to be wearing that thing." I looked down at the Sail to Your Destiny T-shirt I was wearing, aware for the first time that I'd gone to bed fully dressed. As well as the T-shirt, I was also wearing my jeans. No wonder I was melting. I took my jeans and socks off, but left the T-shirt on. Even though I'd lost a lot of weight lately, I still felt self-conscious every now and then, even around Lucy. Feeling cooler in my boxers, I sat cross-legged on the deck next to her. The day was cloudless, the sea calm, and in the distance I could see the southeast coast of England. A slight breeze cooled the sweat on my face and bare legs. "Do you want to talk about it?" Lucy asked. "Talk about what?" "Last night. The last couple of weeks. How you're feeling?" I shrugged. "I just keep thinking about my dad and my brother stuck in that camp, believing that the army is going to keep them safe. We've seen what happens to the camps once the zombies decide to attack." "You asked them to come with us, and they refused. There's nothing else you could have done, Alex." She sat up and put a hand on my shoulder. "I know this has been bothering you ever since you saw your family, but you have to stop beating yourself up about it." "You're right," I said. "But it'll probably just take some time."
"Of course it will,"
she said softly, squeezing my shoulder. "Now, why don't you put some music on and we can chill for a while before we go ashore?" That sounded like a good idea. I needed some time to recover from last night's excess before I tackled a food run. I went into the living area and turned the radio on, wincing as Def Leppard blared out of the speakers. Why was everything so loud? Grabbing a pair of sunglasses from the counter, I put them on and retreated to the aft deck, then climbed the ladder up to the bridge, where the pulse of the music was still audible but wasn't so deafening. Sitting on the pilot's chair, I leaned my elbows on the instrument panel and put my head in my hands, silently pleading with my headache to go away. I'd only been there for what seemed like 10 minutes before the radio crackled and a voice came through the static.
"This is Echo 6. Does anyone copy? Over."
I sat up in the seat but didn't key the radio. This sounded like a military unit calling others in the area. Our past experience with the military had been both good and bad, but the bad had taught me it was best to stay out of their way. So I thought it best not to give away the fact that we were close enough to receive this broadcast from Echo 6. After a couple of moments, the voice spoke again.
"This is Echo 6. Does anyone copy? Over."
I glanced at the clock on the wall and realized that what I thought had been a 10-minute nap had actually lasted an hour and a half. The headache was becoming duller, but now my neck and shoulders felt stiff from sleeping in such an awkward position.
"This is Echo 6. We require immediate assistance. Is there anybody out there? Over."
Echo 6 wasn't getting any response to his call for help. His voice, which had seemed calm when he'd begun broadcasting, now held a note of urgency.
"Is there anybody out there? Anyone at all?"
I heard another voice, someone in the same room as the speaker, say,
"It's no good, Sarge. No one can hear you. We might as well accept that we're not getting out of this."
"This is Echo 6," the original speaker said into the radio. "Mayday! Mayday! Mayday!"
I don't know what it was about that broadcast. Maybe the note of panic in the speaker's voice. Maybe the fact that the other person there seemed resigned to his fate. But something made me pick up my own radio and press the talk button.
"Echo 6, I hear you. Over."
"Oh, thank God. We need immediate assistance. Our vehicle has broken down and we have a number of enemies approaching our position."
He reeled off a set of coordinates that meant nothing to me. I quickly scribbled them down on the notepad next to the radio.
"Please," he added, after giving me the coordinates. "We need help."
I opened the bridge door and leaned out, looking over at the lucky escape. Sam and Tanya were both on the sun deck, soaking up the sun. I called over to them.
"Hey, someone's in trouble."
Tanya turned her head towards me, shielding her eyes from the sun with her hand, even though she was wearing a pair of large sunglasses that covered most of her face. "We're in the middle of a zombie apocalypse, Alex. A lot of people are in trouble."
"No, I mean there's someone on the radio asking for help."
I seized the notebook and read out the coordinates. "Is that far from here?"
Up on those cliffs, Sam said, pointing to the shore. The cliffs were vertical and rose at least 300 feet from the sea.
There's no way we're going to get up there.
He was right. Without a helicopter, we weren't going to get anywhere near Echo 6. The radio squawked again, and now the soldier's voice sounded even more desperate.
If the person I was talking to is still there, please respond. We need your help. Can you hear me? Over.
I hesitated, my thumb hovering over the talk button. I didn't have the heart to tell this guy that there was no way I could help him, that his cry for help was futile. I wondered for a moment if I should tell him we were on our way, but a false sense of hope might be just as bad as no hope at all. If I told these soldiers that we were coming to help them, they'd eventually realize it wasn't true. What if their last moments alive were spent dealing with the crushing knowledge that they'd been lied to? I pressed the talk button, then released it again. What should I say? I pressed the button again, and then let it go for a second time. I didn't have the words. I couldn't tell these people that I wasn't going to help them. The soldier's voice came through the static. He sounded a little calmer. Maybe he was resigned to his fate, as his companion seemed to be. "What's your name?" he asked calmly. He knew I was here, and that I was hesitating. Each time I'd pressed the talk button and released it without speaking, he would have heard a telltale click on his end. "Alex," I said, trying to keep my voice flat, but doing a bad job of it. I was trembling.
"Alex, listen carefully. My name is Sergeant Terry Locke. My team and I are in a broken-down Army Land Rover at the coordinates I gave you. We're armed, but the amount of zombies advancing on our position is too great. Our ammunition will soon be depleted. We're going down, Alex."
In the background, I could hear gunshots and someone shouting,
"Take that, you undead fuckers!"
My grip on the radio tightened. These might be Sergeant Terry Locke's last words. I didn't want to hear him and his team get ripped apart by zombies.
"I'm going to tell you something very important, Alex," Sergeant Locke continued. "There are items in this Land Rover that need to get to Dr. Sarah Ives at Bunker 53. It is vitally important that these items reach her. Do you copy?"
I don't know where Bunker 53 is," I told him.
"There's a map in the vehicle."
He raised his voice as the automatic gunfire around him increased in intensity.
"Listen carefully, Alex. These items are more important than any of us. My mission ends here, but you need to continue it. The fate of what's left of the world may depend on it. Over."
"All right," I said, determined to help. If I couldn't save Sergeant Locke, at least I could take these items to the doctor he'd mentioned. "I'll find a way to get to your vehicle. It may take some time, but I'll do it. Over."
"There isn't much time," he said. "There's a squad of soldiers on our tail. Now that we've broken down, they'll reach this location fairly soon. They must not be allowed to retrieve the items from the Land Rover. If they do, our efforts were wasted, and we will have died for nothing. Over."
"What do you mean, soldiers on your tail? I thought you were soldiers. Over."
"We are. But we went against our orders and stole these items from Camp Victor. We couldn't let them continue what they were doing. We tried to stop Operation Dead Ground. Don't let them get the items back. If Operation Dead Ground continues, it could mean the end of the human race."
I heard a loud crash and a scream.
"This is it," the sergeant said. "Goodbye, Alex, and good luck. Over and out."
The channel went dead, and the radio transmitted only static.
Chapter 2. "We have to help them," I said. The four of us were sitting at the table in the living area of the Big Easy. Lucy next to me, Sam and Tanya opposite us. I had called the meeting and told everyone about the radio transmission from Echo 6. It was now 10 minutes since the radio had gone dead.
"Sounds like it's too late to help them," Sam said.
"But what about the items in their Land Rover?" Sergeant Locke said if they fell into the wrong hands, the human race could be in danger.
"We have no idea what it is," Lucy said, "and retrieving it will be dangerous. Haven't we faced enough danger to last us a lifetime?"
I couldn't argue with that. Since the outbreak of the virus that had torn our world apart, we'd fought zombies, soldiers, and Patient Zero. We'd risked our lives to get vaccines to military camps, and we'd fought our way inland to a radio station. We'd seen our fair share of trouble, but did that mean we were supposed to stop fighting? After seeing my dad and brother cowering in a survivor's camp, I'd made a pledge to not be like them, to stand up and fight against the zombies whenever I had to. "We can't just ignore this," I said. "What if the items in the Land Rover really could destroy everyone? Whatever Operation Dead Ground is, it doesn't sound good. The clue is in the name. Sergeant Locke and his team were willing to risk court-martial and even death to stop it."
"Alex is right," Tanya said.
"The Land Rover and whatever's inside it is sitting just up there on those cliffs. And a group of soldiers, maybe bad soldiers, want to get their hands on it. I'm willing to grab this item before they do and screw up their plans."
"But what makes you think this situation is survivable?"
Lucy asked. "If the Echo 6 team got killed by nasties, why do you think we'll fare any better?" "They were trapped inside their vehicle," I told her. "It sounds like their Land Rover broke down, and then they suddenly had a swarm of zombies surrounding them. They were immobilized. We won't have that disadvantage."
"We can find a car," Tanya said.
"That way, we'll be able to keep moving while we engage the nasties. We might even be able to lead them away from the Land Rover, and then double back when it's safer."
"So we're agreed?" I asked, looking at Lucy.
"We'll do it."
She shrugged and said flatly, "Sure, why not?"
Her heart didn't seem in it, but at least she'd acquiesced.
"So how are we going to get on top of the cliffs?" I asked, looking at Tanya and Sam for answers. If anyone knew about rock climbing, it was those two. But we didn't have any climbing gear, and even if we did, I couldn't see myself scaling those cliffs. I'd probably die halfway up, either from exhaustion or vertigo.
"We don't need to climb the cliffs," Tanya said. "There's a village with a harbour, a few miles north of here. We get ashore, hotwire a car, and drive to the location the soldier gave you. Simple."
We all looked at each other. The village was probably going to be infested with zombies. It wasn't going to be that simple.
"Sounds like a plan," Sam said.
I couldn't think of any other way we were going to get to the broken-down Land Rover, so I nodded.
"Sure, let's do it."
Lucy sighed. "Yeah, whatever."
"You can stay with the boats if you like, Lucy," Tanya said. "There's no need for all four of us to go."
"You can both stay," Sam suggested.
"Tanya and I will handle this."
"No way," I said. "I'm coming. I'm the one who answered the call." I knew this mission was going to be dangerous, but I felt that if I didn't go to the Land Rover personally, as I'd promised Sergeant Locke I would, I'd be letting him and his team down.
"Okay, man," Sam said, holding his hands up in mock surrender. "You can come too."
"I'll wait with the boats," Lucy offered.
"Great," Sam said. "Let's head north and find the harbour."
5 minutes later, I was sitting on the Zodiac with Sam and Tanya. Sam was in the stern, using the outboard motor's tiller to steer us towards a small harbour in the distance. Tanya was kneeling in the bow, scanning the shoreline through a pair of binoculars. Sitting on the floor by Sam's feet was a small box known as a magpie. Military drones patrolled the coast, and they'd take out any vehicle or personnel they detected. The magpie emitted a signal which told the drones we were friendly. As we sped across the water, cold, salty spray flew into my face. I turned my head so I was looking behind us, and I saw the Big Easy and Lucky Escape sitting out in deeper water. Lucy stood leaning on the Big Easy's railings, watching the Zodiac cut through the sea towards land. From this distance, I couldn't see her face, but I was sure her gaze was expressionless. Sam saw me, looking back the way we'd come, and shouted so I could hear him above the splashing water and the growl of the motor.
"Don't worry about her, man. She'll be fine."
"It isn't that," I told him. "It's just that she was really down on us helping those soldiers. That isn't like her at all." He shrugged.
"She's been through a lot, man. We all have. She's allowed to feel down whenever she wants."
I nodded. "Yeah, of course." I didn't expect Lucy to be happy all the time. Given the circumstances we found ourselves in, it was a miracle we found any moments of happiness at all. But I was worried that she was isolating herself from the reality of our situation. Whenever going ashore was mentioned, whether for a food run or to help someone like the soldiers who had called us on the radio, she became cold. I didn't know if it was because each time we went ashore, we might never return, or if she was trying to forget what was happening on the mainland and focus her thoughts only on the relatively comfortable and safe world of the boat. If that was the case, I really couldn't blame her. We all wanted to feel safe, and the boat was the perfect haven from the zombie-infested mainland. But I found it impossible to remain in the bubble of protection afforded by the Big Easy, when I knew someone needed help. Maybe that was where Lucy and I differed. She could ignore a cry for help, where I could not. "There's no movement on the shore," Tanya said, still peering through the binoculars. "And we'll get a choice of vehicle. I can see plenty of cars parked near the harbour. No boats, though. They were probably used to get everyone from the village to safety."
"Things are looking good so far,"
Sam said, ever the optimist. He throttled down as we got closer to the harbour and guided the Zodiac to the wooden jetty. Tanya grabbed the mooring rope and jumped onto the jetty before securing the Zodiac to a cleat. I picked up the duffel bag of weapons from between my feet and tossed it to her. Then, followed closely by Sam, I climbed out of the boat and onto the wooden planks of the jetty. Opening the bag, Tanya selected a Walther PPK handgun and an M16 rifle, which she slung over her shoulder. Sam and I did the same. The weapons were courtesy of the government, when they'd recruited us to deliver vials of a vaccine to a number of army bases, and had come in handy on a number of occasions. The only problem was we were running low on ammo. In consideration of this fact, we'd also brought 3 baseball bats with us. In close quarters, they were just as useful as a gun. Actually, they were our weapon of choice because they didn't make any noise. A gunshot would attract zombies from miles around. Brandishing a bat each, we left the empty duffel bag on the jetty and walked slowly and carefully to the shore. Tanya hadn't seen any obvious movement through the binoculars, but that didn't mean someone couldn't be hiding in one of the buildings nearby, or that there wasn't a horde of zombies around here, standing dormant until they heard a sound.
"This place is creepy," I whispered. "It's like a ghost town."
The road from the harbour climbed the cliff and was bordered by a number of houses, but all of them seemed empty. A small car park near where we stood was full of cars. This was probably the place where the residents parked their vehicles, since there wasn't any space on the narrow road outside the houses.
"They definitely didn't drive out of here," Tanya said.
"Maybe they all sailed away."
"Or the army took them," I said.
Since the apocalypse had begun, the army seemed hell-bent on rounding up all the survivors and placing them in military camps. They even used a government-run radio station, Survivor Radio, which urged everyone to go to their nearest camp. My dad and brother were in one of those camps, but I had no desire to join them. The last place I wanted to be was trapped behind walls and fences, reliant on the military to protect me from the nasties. At least out here, I could choose my own destiny, and even help others when the opportunity arose. It was a far cry from my former life as a nerdy gamer, working a dead-end job and living off fast food. We reached the cars, and Sam pointed at a silver Nissan X-Trail. He went over to it and tried the driver's door. It opened. Sam leaned inside and gave us a thumbs up.
The keys are inside.
I guess the owners knew they weren't coming back, Tanya said, moving around to the passenger side. I got in behind Sam and placed my weapons beside me on the back seat. He started the engine and inspected the gauges on the dashboard.
Half a tank of petrol, more than enough for our needs.
He put the vehicle into reverse and backed out of the parking space, spinning the steering wheel so we pointed in the direction of the road. Tanya took a map out of her pocket and opened it. She pointed at it and said to Sam, "We're here." She traced her finger along the paper and stopped at an area she'd circled with a red pen. "We need to get to here."
"No problem."
Sam put the X-Trail into gear and drove steadily to the car park's exit. Then he turned onto the road that wound past the houses and up to the top of the cliffs. As we rolled past the houses, I watched their windows for signs of life. Or maybe signs of movement would be a better term, since life wasn't required for something to be moving in those buildings, now that the apocalypse was here. After seeing nothing behind the windows, I sat back in my seat and relaxed a little. The village appeared to be completely deserted.
"How long until we get to the Land Rover?" I asked.
"A couple of minutes," Tanya said. "It isn't far." I felt a mounting sense of anticipation and fear. We knew the Land Rover had been attacked by zombies. Those same zombies would still be hanging around, and more would be arriving, attracted by the sound of gunfire. Not to mention the soldiers Sergeant Locke had warned me of. They would also be on their way to the area. We were driving into a hotbed of activity. We reached the cliff top. The road levelled out and then intersected a larger main road. Sam turned left and we drove south. This road was lined with dry stone walls and, beyond them, I could see fields. In the distance, figures moved through the grass with slow, stumbling gaits. They were zombies, and they were also moving south. A couple of minutes later, I was jerked forward against my seatbelt when Sam hit the brakes suddenly.
"Looks like this is the place," he said.
The road ahead was crowded with shambling zombies. They seemed to have got onto the road by pushing through the dry stone walls, because there were stones everywhere and the walls were destroyed. I guessed that this pack of creatures had been wandering in the fields when Echo 6's Land Rover had broken down. It had probably only taken a couple of minutes for the undead to stagger onto the road and surround the vehicle. I could see Echo 6's Land Rover in the middle of the horde. The tailgate was open, but no gunfire issued from the vehicle, so I assumed everyone inside was dead. Almost in unison, the zombies turned to face our vehicle. Their skin was the mottled grey-blue of dead flesh, and the whites of their eyes had turned yellow. Many of them bore wounds that told the tale of their manner of death. Some had missing limbs, others deep scratches that had ripped their flesh apart. Their clothes were ragged and torn, probably as a result of the undead corpses wandering around the countryside without regard for obstacles in their path.
"If I reverse back along the road," Sam said, "maybe I can lead them away from the Land Rover."
His words were cut off, and I leaned forward to see what had made him stop talking.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?